Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Political strategist Carl Calabrese from Masiello, Martucci, Calabrese and Associates is in studio this morning. There is a lot to talk about, Carl. It seems like from the county executive race to the debate to Nancy Pelosi, Governor Cuomo, we'll try to get to all of it this morning. But let's start with the candidates in conversation, the two-day forum that we held here on WBEN in the 8 o'clock hours, both Monday and Tuesday, with Mark Poloncarz and Lynn Dixon in studio. It was a different kind of a format. It wasn't a debate. It was a much more a long form format. Tone and style of these two, pretty different, isn't it?
Oh, it is. They're both very different people. I thought it was an interesting format. It was in depth. It was relaxed. It was conversational. Nothing like a debate. But neither one of them broke any new ground in terms of the campaign strategy and direction. The county executive stayed on the message that he's been staying with, and if you're an incumbent, that's just where you want to be. But there was no new issues or new directions from the Dixon campaign yet. I'm watching this campaign, and the campaign manager for Lynn Dixon is known within Republican circles as a very aggressive campaign manager and strategist and tactician. We haven't seen that yet out of her campaign. And I'm a kind of a history buff and a military buff. I think there's a lot of similarities between a military campaign and a political campaign. And I'm thinking that back in the winter of 1939, 1940, the French army was facing the German army on the border of France and Germany. And for the entire winter, nobody did anything. They just looked at each other. And it's been called the phony war. Well, now we know it was the calm before the storm, because as soon as the weather broke, so did the blitzkrieg. And I'm kind of wondering, going into the last 2.5 weeks of the campaign, if that may not be the case here, that this may be the lull before the storm. Because if you're going to beat an incumbent, you have to identify a new issue, and you have to isolate it, and you have to make it number one on people's minds going into the election. And that's what you have to do, and I'm going to be watching very closely to see if that's the direction the Dixon campaign takes in the last 18, 19 days.
Well, I was going to say, the election is 3 weeks from yesterday, but early voting starts in 10 days. So when would that attack begin?
Oh, I think it's got to start... if not tomorrow, by next week for sure. If they have such an issue, they may not. This may be it. But that's what I'm watching from a strategy standpoint. Is the campaign going to take a new direction? Is going to be more hard hitting? Right now, as I say, Mark Poloncarz he's in the zone he wants to be in. He's talking about his government, his record, and if you're an incumbent, that's where you want to be. And there's really nothing controversial. There's no fires being lit and stoked right now, and that's good if you're an incumbent.
Where is Poloncarz vulnerable?
I think if you look at let's go back to 1999 when Joel Giambo ran against Dennis Gorski. In many ways, Dennis Gorski and Mark Poloncarz are similar from a style standpoint. Neither one of them is known as a backslapping politician type of person. They're both very analytical. They're very, very focused, intense. Dennis Gorski ran his campaign on, that he was a good administrator. He had a scandal-free government. He controlled taxes. That had been a winning message for him. What the Giambo campaign did was not campaign there, okay? They created a new issue in the future, and that is, how do we govern ourselves in the future in this community? And, of course, the theory was regionalism, more cooperation, collaboration, service sharing. Let's stop all the duplication and the layers of costs here. And that was a ground that Dennis Gorski did not want to fight on and wasn't particularly good at it, and that changed the whole nature of that 1999 campaign. Now, I don't know if there's such an issue going forward for the Republicans this year, but generally speaking, if you're going to beat an incumbent for anything, town supervisor, mayor, governor, president, usually it has to be about an issue going forward. in the future and get the incumbent off the ground they want to fight on the ground they don't want to fight on.
Is this a close race? There really hasn't been any polling for the public to see on this race at all.
No, I think that's going to start real soon, though. I would bet you right now that the Buffalo News is in the process and maybe even wrapping up their first poll, what's called in the political business a benchmark poll. Where do we stand, you know, 2 weeks out, 2.5 weeks out? That's being done. I know both candidates are doing polling, but what's really interesting this year is there's no leakage here. There's no buzz on the street, rumors right. that, you know, one campaign is up 10 and the other one is. And there's nothing like that. I was asked that question on your station the other day, and I haven't heard a peep from either campaign about internal polling. So I guess we'll have to either wait for someone to get loose lips or wait for the Buffalo News poll, and that'll be a front page poll. That may come out. They usually do that on Sundays as a front page story on Sunday, so I wouldn't be surprised if this Sunday we see that.
All right. On roads, it would seem that may be Lynn Dixon's biggest argument, and they seem to have a different plan, each of them, when it comes to fixing roads in Erie County. Who wins the argument after listening to both of them?
This is a perennial argument in the county executive race. The very first political race as a young college student I ever worked on was a county executive race back in the 70s. And they were talking about roads then. I mean, it's just every 4 years we're going to have this debate. It's basically the same debate if you're a Republican and if you're a Democrat. It's the same roads in the same area of the county. It's the same discussion about budget and political influence in roads. You know, I just don't think it's a game changer if you're trying to beat an incumbent. It may get some people's attention at the beginning, but if you're going to cross the finish line, I don't think it's going to be with roads unless, number one, if you have some terrible, terrible roads where you're looking at multiple accidents and injuries and even fatalities, or if you have a scandal with a road construction company that graft and corruption is misusing the public money. If you have one or both of those, then I think you've got an issue. You might be able to ride to victory. But just on the kind of esoteric debate about how many road miles we have and what the budget is, it's just every 4 years. And people just kind of, they're used to it. They've discounted it as a game-changing issue, in my opinion.
Governor Cuomo was live on WAMC radio in Albany yesterday when discussing the negative connotations about Italian-Americans, he used a racial slur.
They used an expression that Southern Italians were called, I believe they're saying Southern Italians, Sicilians, I'm half Sicilian, were called, quote-unquote, and pardon my language, but I'm just quoting the Times, wops.
Democratic Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie, who is black, says he was not offended. However, president of the Black Institute, Bertha Lewis, said Cuomo appears to think he has so much privilege that he thinks he can say anything. Let me bring in Carl Calabrese this morning for just a moment here. Should Governor Cuomo have known better when he was on the radio yesterday?
I think the general rule to follow for all politicians at all levels of government from both parties is just don't use the word. Just say N-word. Just don't use it. There's no good that can come from using the word. I understand what he was trying to say about his heritage and the background of his heritage, but it's probably best not to say it. Now, having brought it up, there's no question in my mind that if this were a Republican using that word, it would be all over the media. And I haven't seen or heard anything of it yet, other than right here, okay? But you bring it up. But I don't believe it's in the morning edition of the Buffalo News. I could be wrong because I've only looked at the front page. But it's just, if this were a Republican, not only would it be mentioned, there would be a drumbeat. There would be that drumbeat. It would have led the national news television shows last night. It would have been the talk of all of the cable news stations on the left. It would have been on radio. Would have been in the newspaper. There would have been a drumbeat had this been a Republican. And I think this probably will show us that bias that exists within the media in terms of dealing with a Republican who makes a mistake versus a Democrat who makes a mistake.
And because he's a Democrat, this will probably just blow over.
Probably, sure.
The supersized debate last night at Otterbein University in Ohio, outside of Columbus. Strategist Carl Calabrese is here this morning. He watched this debate. With 12 candidates on the stage, Carl, it's like Survivor, isn't it, in a little bit?
It's Survivor, yeah, for the candidates. It's an ordeal for the viewing public. 3 hours is just, it's mind-numbing, 3 hours with that many candidates. It's just, you know, it's just too much. you really have to be a political junkie to watch it, like me and others. But you know, no new ground was broken in terms of issues. None. I mean, it was the same issues we've heard the previous three debates, the same positions from the same candidates.
Who's rising and who's falling this morning?
Well, Warren is definitely rising, and you could tell because, you know, one of the things a lot of pundits were saying was, you know, will the candidates finally focus in and zero in their fire on Joe Biden, the leader? Well, no. The answer was they zeroed in on Elizabeth Warren, which tells you the folks up at that podium felt that it's now Elizabeth Warren who's in the lead. And so, you know, she was attacked on her Medicare for All proposal and what it was going to cost. And she was attacked for advocating removing 170 million people from private insurance. And there were those kinds of attacks on her. So there's no question that the players in this game right now think Elizabeth Warren is the leader. And if you look at the polls, and I do, you know, almost every day, they're basically three or four major polls out there. She's ahead in three of them. She's only behind in one. And the trend has been towards her. I mean, Joe Biden, not many months ago, had a 14, 15, 16-point lead. Now, in the one poll, he's ahead of 4 or 5 points. And others, he's behind. And just, in fact, more importantly, if you look at the first two events, Iowa caucus and New Hampshire primary, she's ahead in both. And we all know what happens in presidential season. If you win those two, you have momentum. You're like a jet engine that kicks into afterburner going into the next few races. She's also ahead in Nevada. The only place where he looks strong right now is South Carolina. That's primarily because of the very large African-American population, which up to this point is sticking with Joe Biden and not looking at Warren or Sanders very much. But in the first four events of the primary year, she's ahead right now.
Who do you think won't be part of this on the stage for the next debate in November?
I think a number of them. Right now there's three or four that don't qualify. Tulsi Gabbard, Robert Francis O'Rourke,
Klobuchar.
She's on the bubble.
But she was fighting last night.
She had she had probably her best debate. She had, I thought, the best line of the debate when, you know, of course, we see class warfare now dominating the Democrat economic debate. Didn't hear anything about how to grow an economy. You heard a lot about, you know, how to get the rich. And she had a great line where she said, nobody wants to defend billionaires. She pointed over to Steyer, who is a multi-billionaire, who got his money, by the way, through fossil fuels and now is talking about climate change. That's his number one issue. But she said, no one wants to defend billionaires. And she pointed to Steyer and said, not even the billionaire wants to defend billionaires. I thought that was a pretty good line.
That is a good one. Why was Tom Steyer there? I mean, right, he's a multi-billionaire, but they have polling and fundraising restrictions, right?
Yeah, he obviously met them. He obviously met the two requirements. I think you have to be a 2% in the four polls that the Democrat Party has identified as the polls, as the official polls of the Democrat Party. Not your poll, not somebody newspaper's poll, but the four they have chosen. You have to be at 2%. And then you have to raise a certain amount of money in a certain number of states with at least 400 individual donors. And it's complicated, but those are the benchmarks that the party has set up to qualify for these debates. And right now there's three or four people on that stage last night who are not going to meet them. I'm surprised there were that many candidates on the stage last night. I thought a few of them might not meet those benchmarks going into the last night's debate, but It's going to be tough. They purposely made it tough with the hope of winnowing down the field so we didn't see what we saw last night of a stage that goes on for a country mile.
Strategist Carl Calabrese is in studio this morning. We're looking back at last night's Democratic debate in Ohio, debate number four. We've brought up some of the highlights from the debate last night and the fact that Elizabeth Warren got the most speaking time last night. What about Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, who both had a lot on the line last night?
Absolutely. Let me just say that Elizabeth Warren is a very good debater. She's got a very quick mind, retains a lot of facts, and she's very passionate. And that's exciting the Democrat base right now. And that's why you see her moving up in the polls. Joe Biden had, another spotty performance. I mean, there was a time when he was confusing the president of Turkey with the president of Syria. He was slurring his words. He said something about people clipping coupons for the stock market, which I have no idea what that meant. And there are times when he's giving an answer where he gets that deer in the headlights look in his eyes, like he's having trouble remembering where he's going next. I remember during the Republican debates of 2016, Governor Rick Perry was giving an answer about the three departments of the federal government that he would eliminate if he were president. And he started to name them. And after he got through the second one, he forgot the third one. That essentially ended his presidential race.
Oh, yeah, we all remember
and
that.
Every one of these debates, I think, were on the line there that you could see a similar situation with Joe Biden. So he did not have a real good performance. Bernie Sanders, on the other hand, I thought had a good performance from the standpoint of just answering those questions about what his health was like. He looked better than I thought he would. And he's still the feisty old, you know, angry Bernie of talking about an American Revolution and talking about the greed of the capitalist, and he's still the same guy. Now, it still may weigh on people's minds that given his age and given the heart attack, that maybe it's best to look somewhere else at one of the other candidates. But as of last night's performance, if you didn't know he had a health issue before this debate, you would not have known it by watching
That's
the debate
point.
Last night.
All right. And the other thing is the three front runners, Biden, Warren and Sanders, all in their 70s. I mean, the age issue is coming up for all of them.
Yeah, it is. And it surfaced at the last debate when Julian Castro brought it up right at the podium about Joe Biden forgetting his answers. And then afterwards, in the post-debate interviews, Cory Booker brought it up with one of the networks. So they've broached that topic now publicly. And if he continues to fall, it probably won't be an issue that's brought up. But if he rebounds, I think you'll see it resurface again.
Is 7 Carl Calabrese, political strategist with Masiello, Martucci, Calabrese & Associates, in studio. We've been reviewing our candidates in conversation, also the Democratic debate last night. And now let's talk about what's happening at the Capitol. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, announced last night, just a little bit before, about an hour before the debate started, that there would be no vote on impeachment. Now is not the time. So read between the lines.
Yeah, they're quite a disconnect.
Why did she say that?
Quite a disconnect between the candidates on the stage and what they want to do, which is basically try, convict, and execute the president, you know, even right away, versus the speaker saying there will not be a vote. Very, very practical political reasons why the speaker said that and doesn't want to go down that path. She's got 30 members of her caucus that were elected from congressional districts that voted for Donald Trump in 2016, many of them by double digits. So there are Democrats in very Trump-friendly districts. She does not want to put them on the line voting for impeachment, knowing that that could risk their re-election in 2020 and thereby risk her majority and her speakership. So she's going to do everything she can to avoid putting those 30 Democrats in that position in order to maintain her speakership.
So where's this inquiry going?
That's a good question. I mean, we've got precedent of two 20th century impeachment proceedings against Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton. And both were handled in certain ways, totally different than the way she's handling this one. They were both handled by the Judiciary Committee, not the Intelligence Committee. They were what's called unified staffs, where both Republicans and Democrats had lawyers working together. The president's lawyers were allowed to come into the proceedings just like a trial and look at evidence, disclosure. Things were done in the open. This one is, by putting it in the Intelligence Committee, is allowing Adam Schiff to say, well, I can't release anything publicly unless he wants to. So we don't know who the whistleblower is, and we may not know. I mean, that's outrageous that this person is giving testimony in secret, and whatever Adam Schiff wants to leak out, he leaks out. You know, someone said he's acting like a prosecutor, a DA with a grand jury, that it's his grand jury. The difference is the law prevents a DA from leaking anything going on within a grand jury proceeding. It's top secret. He's selectively leaking things from those proceedings, which, again, I think is outrageous and is tainting the whole process, if you want to give it the dignity of calling it a process. And so that's the problem with this whole thing. It's very partisan. It's very secret. You know, we live in a time when you cannot get through a day without hearing the word transparency 30 times. And this is anything but. This is impeachment in secret, and I just don't think it's going to fly.
Well, I mean, the administration's calling it illegitimate, and they're saying they're not going to cooperate. What about Rudy Giuliani? And now all the heat that he is under at this point.
Yeah, I think...
Does he need to distance himself from the president?
Yeah, I think so. I think Trump wants to do that. In fact, he wanted to hire Trey Gowdy, the former congressman and prosecutor. But there's some lobbying rules that prevent Gowdy from coming onto the job until, I think, January. But when he announced he wanted to bring Gowdy on the team, I thought that was the first signal that he's going to ease Rudy out. That's probably how he'll do it, subtly, and bring somebody else in. I wouldn't be surprised to see that occur over the next few months.
All right. And what about the president right now with the decision with Syria and Turkey?
Bad decision. We probably never should have been in Syria, okay? And remember, Trump ran on ending endless wars. So he's got support for this. If you look at the polls, people want to get out. The way he did it, though,
betraying the Kurds.
Yeah, there were a lot of ways he could have done this and gotten out with far less chaos and far less questioning about the future of the Kurds and everything else that's going on there. So it was clumsy. It was very clumsy on his part. Although, again, he ran on this. I think his long-term vision is correct. These are quagmires waiting to happen for America. But getting out as hastily as he did looked clumsy. It looked amateurish, and I think he's paid a price for it in public opinion.
We always appreciate your insight, Carl. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Carl Calabrese with Masiello, Martucci, Calabrese & Associates.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.